Welcome to the podcast service of Sydney's 103.2, available on the web at heart1032.com.au.
David Bissot, welcome to Open House.
Thank you.
Or should I say, thanks for welcoming me to your lounge room.
That would also be appropriate, yeah.
Congratulations on Senior Australian of the Year. It's a wonderful award to get.
Appreciate your sentiments, yeah.
Who would have thought 30 years ago when you founded this whole idea of Opportunity International and particularly the micro-enterprise concept that goes hand in hand with it, that it would be, I guess, so widely applauded? Did you ever think that it would be 30 years ago?
I never expected it to be as prominent as it is now. In fact, when we first conceived of the idea, we were ridiculed and ostracized by most of people in the aid community. And simply because I dared to suggest that there was a biblical concept of wealth creation rather than wealth redistribution, which was probably more effective for addressing poverty than the typical charitable handout methodology. So for decades, our programs were not appreciated by people in the aid community who were more locked into a socialist paradigm of redistribution of the world's resources. And my thesis was, well, why restrict ourselves to a cake that's this small? Why don't we make a bigger cake and then more people can have more? Why don't we enable people in the two-thirds world to create their own wealth and then you don't have to get locked into the Robin Hood.
When did you first realise that this whole idea of giving small loans to poor entrepreneurs could actually work?
Most of my ideas are very pragmatic. We were living in Indonesia in a remote village, and we're building a dam and a school and a church and some other infrastructure things. And most of the people working on the projects were tenant farmers. And one of the farmers, Ketut Suwiria, was sharing with me that he already had three children and they were about 6, 7, and 8 years old. One of them was old enough to go and work in a carpet factory or a cigarette factory because they owed so much money to the landowners and the loan sharks. He was telling me that his wife was pregnant with their fourth child and that while the child was still in the mother's womb, he was going to inherit three generations of debt. Of course, I was incensed that that was happening to this new creation of God. And it seemed so simple to me that all that Ketut needed was some way to be more productive. I could have said, well, look, you know, I'll buy your children out of debt or I'll take the family out of debt, but there would have been no dignity or pride in that. So, you know, I offered to give him a loan of $50 to buy a sewing machine so that his wife could sew clothes. He paid back the $50 and bought another sewing machine and gave someone a job, and that concept snowballed. And today, you know, we're making more than a million of those per year around the world in 32 countries.
It's amazing growth. Let's go back, though, because at the age of 4, you actually entered a boys' home. From what you can remember, what was the home life like that you were removed from?
There wasn't much home life because even before the age of 4, I was placed in what they call health camps in New Zealand, which were camps for undernourished children to go to. Obviously, I fit into that category. But the recollections of life in the home, in the parental home, were pretty sketchy. But things that stand out for me was that there was a very violent household. There were a lot of arguments going on, a lot of drinking, a lot of knives being thrown around, and a very dysfunctional situation. So I imagine that's the reason why the social welfare department removed me from that situation and placed me in a boys' home.
Have you ever had any contact with your birth parents?
No, I've not. They've never contacted me and I've never contacted them. I was born in 1940, so it was a period during the war, so one doesn't know even if they are still alive.
And I know that you actually say that growing up in the boys' home actually probably helped you to become the man that you are today, actually helped to propel you forward to actually be a problem solver and things. How did that work out?
I think in the boys' home, there were 40 other boys as well, so you became very resourceful. It was a sort of a cooperative arrangement, a self-supporting farm where we had cows that had to be milked and chickens and vegetable gardens and cooking, our own bakery, and the kids did everything themselves. So in terms of being multi-skilled, it was certainly fantastic context, because one did come out with a whole range of skills which I've been able to apply to the various entrepreneurial interests that I've been engaged in. But I think probably one of the most powerful things that I was taught in those boys' homes was discipline, really, and taking responsibility for your own mistakes. And even up to date, you know, I go through life saying everything's my fault. You know, even if you could blame it onto someone else, it's much easier if you can just say everything's my fault and find a way around it.
Well, around Australia, this is Open House, and we are in the lounge room of the Senior Australian of the Year, David Bussow. We're going to podcast this via the openhouse.net.au. That's David Bussow, the orphan. Let's move on to David Bussow, the entrepreneur. At what age did you realise you had this creative business streak in you?
Very early age, 16. When I left the boys' home, I started up a hot dog stand outside a football stadium. Very quickly, that developed into two hot dog stands, and I had somebody else working it. But I moved from hot dogs to hamburgers to fish and chips to cake shops to biscuit factories to pikelet manufacturing to food distribution, food exporting. For 10 years, I worked in the food industry. And typically, I would buy into a business that had potential, and I would never hold on to it for anything more than 1 or 2 years. So I would buy potential rather than actual profit, and then sell potential and make a capital gain on that.
That itself is part of the gift, though, isn't it, to be able to see the potential?
It is. It is a gift, and I think I bring that even into everything I do now. It's spotting people that have the potential and investing in them. The impact is much greater if you can invest in the potential of people rather than their actual current results.
Now, I can understand the transition from hot dog stands to hamburgers to fish and chips to you went into bakeries and things like that. Then you went into construction. Now, I don't understand that jump.
I often get asked that question, but for me, it's pretty logical, you know. I mean, mixing cakes, mixing concrete, I mean, just a different sort of mixer. That's part of my personality. I'm impetuous. I'm, you know, pretty brazen and pretty arrogant, and I'll have a go at anything. And so, you know, I'm more interested in the opportunity and the challenge. So just because I've not had experience in something doesn't mean that I shouldn't have a go at it. The more challenging it is, the happier I am.
In your teenage years, you had this goal that by the time that you were 40, you'd be a millionaire and you would retire. You actually beat your goal. I believe you retired at the age of 35.
Yeah, I screwed up again, didn't I? I had this, I guess it was a passion to be independent by the time I was 35. And that sort of gave me a 20-year window to do it in. And I think part of the thinking behind that was that the 15 years in the boys' home, where you were disciplined and subjugated and you're basically a statistic, I was rebelling against that. And, you know, my thinking was, you know, I didn't want to be in a position where people had power over me again, where people could dominate me, where people could dictate to me, where people could exploit me even.
So you retire at the age of 35 because your construction company did do so well, and yet you had the wealth, you had the independence, but that led to something of a crisis of meaning, didn't it?
It did, and as usual, you know, God used different things to trigger that consciousness. The first instance that I can recall was an encounter with one of Australia's largest media magnates, and I was renovating one of his palatial homes. And one evening, I was bathing my children in the bath, they were about 2 and 4 at the time, and the phone rings. On the other end of the line, the caller says, "Is this the builder?" And I said, "Yes, this is the builder." He says, "Well, this is Kerry. I'm having a cocktail party tonight, and the catch on the cocktail cabinet that you've just built for me doesn't work, and I'm embarrassed with my guests." He said, "Get your ass over here straight away and fix it." Sort of being the gutless, spineless guy that I was, and he owed me a lot of money, I went and fixed his catch. But it just rammed home to me again that here was someone who had power over me, and I was indignant that this person had the power to forced me to stop bathing my two children, interrupt my family life, and then go and fix up a catch on a cabinet. So that triggered me thinking about, you know, surely there's more I can do with my life than just, you know, pamper to the rich and famous. And so we, you know, we started a process of thinking that through, what that would that mean to back away out of the corporate arena. And in 1974, Christmas Day, Darwin was hit by a cyclone. And I put together a team of tradesmen from my construction companies, and we went up there and did about 3 weeks' work helping to rebuild, get people back in their houses. And then I was asked by the church that I go to whether to go up to Darwin and run a full-scale rebuilding program. We agreed to do that, and I had managers running the different companies that I had here in the retail outlets. So we stayed there for 18 months, and we decided after we moved the family up to Darwin that we would dispose of our businesses and endow a foundation that we could use for doing work that to put back into the community. So we created what we called the Maranatha Trust, and that trust has now existed for nearly 30 years, and it operates from passive investments. The revenue from those passive investments enables us to seed fund various programs around the world.
So a few years after Cyclone Tracy, you and the late Al Whitaker then get together to found what is now known as Opportunity International, which brings us back to where we began on this whole idea of microeconomic development, giving small loans to poor entrepreneurs whom no other bank would even look at. Now, tell me about the seed that they then gave birth to Opportunity International. You'd already talked about your experience in Indonesia. From that point on?
There were two organisations operating separately. There was Maranatha Trust in Australia, working in Asia. And there was another organization in the USA called the Institute for International Development, which Al Whitaker had created. And in 1979, the Institute for International Development decided that it would do work in Indonesia. We didn't know each other at all, but the programs spectacularly failed. The representative of the Institute for International Development, a man called Hilary Dialwas, a Sri Lankan, was living in Jakarta trying to run these programs. He came down to Bali where I was living and fortuitously bumped into each other. And he was telling me his problems, and he adopted the same methodology that we had, at Maranatha Trust had started. And the foundation and IIDI joined together and changed their name to Opportunity International. And that has now spread to 32 countries around the world.
You're involved in so many projects now, and Opportunity then give these little loans to these entrepreneurs who then be successful in business and start employing those people around them. Is there one project that you've seen or Opportunity loan fund that you are excited by or has touched you the most?
Well, there's sort of two ends of the spectrum, you know, that are spectacular. You know, I look at the one end of the spectrum where I see someone who has got a $200 loan, and from that loan they've been able to take their children out of bondage, repay three generations of accumulated debt, and be released and liberated to start life over again. I mean, that's spectacular. At the other end of the spectrum, we have a man who 30 years ago borrowed to start a poultry farm in Ghana. He is now the largest poultry producer in the country, has started his own microenterprise development organization and funded it, and at the last election stood as a candidate for president of the nation, didn't succeed, but now is an advisor to the president and employs about 3,000 people. And there's everything in between there.
It's amazing. Right around Australia, this is Open House. We're in the lounge room of David Bisseau, who is the Senior Australian of the Year. In fact, on that very point, we should actually add that while David Bisseau is an entrepreneur and while he was an orphan and while he's founded Opportunity International, he also is a slave owner himself, isn't he?
He is. He is, yes. And it's a contentious point with some people, particularly with the film that's recently come out, you know, Amazing Grace, which deals with that that exact issue.
You really need to tell the story to clarify this.
The scene is Pakistan. I was approached by a man called Bishop Michael Nasr Ali. He invited me to come and look at a program that the church was trying to run in brick kilns, where there are many millions of people who are enslaved in these brick kilns, and their whole life is in this compound that's a walled compound, and they're not allowed out of the compound because they owe so much money to the brick kiln owners. In the rainy seasons, there's no production, and so they have to borrow from the brick kiln owner to survive. And the conditions in these brick kilns are very, very bad. Children die very frequently. Michael took me out to one of these brick kilns, and we saw a family mixing mud and straw for clay bricks. And they had brought their grandfather out on a stretcher who had arthritis, but he could lean outside the stretcher and mix with his hands still, because they had a production quota that they had to achieve for that day. The children ranged from about 11 down to, I think the youngest one was about 8 months. They just played in the mud. They urinated in the mud, they defecated in the mud, and they played in the mud. While we were watching these people making the clay bricks, we heard a scream, and the mother turned around and realized that the youngest baby had died just because of the scorching heat. The whole family stopped working, and they went over to a tree and dug a hole and buried the child, and then went back to work because they had this quota that they had to achieve for the day. And that really stunned me into saying, well, there's something that I can do about this. We came up with a scheme that we would build our own brick kiln, operate it commercially, and we would buy the slaves from the other brick kiln owners. The reality was that the brick kiln owners didn't really want them as slaves. There was the fact that they owed them so much money that they'd borrowed from the brick kiln owners that they couldn't release them. But if you went to them like we did and offered to pay off that debt, then they were only too happy to release these families to you. We bought, I think it was about 50 families from different brick kilns, and we put them to work in our brick kiln. We liberated these people by enabling them to repay the debt themselves rather than accumulating more debt. The brick kiln that we built had mobile shade areas so that in the scorching heat they could work under shade rather than in the heat. We provided them with better housing. We provided them with a clinic, probably with milking goats so they could give nutrition to their children. We had a nurse on the site. And this was all paid for commercially. It wasn't charity. And we held back 10% of their production every year. That production was to be used for their own houses after they'd paid off their debt. So within 18 months, people were in a position to pay off their own debt, which then allowed me to buy another family out of slavery. We provided land. We did a development project with a subdivision, and each family had a subdivision, and with the bricks that they had produced themselves with their own sweat, they were able to build their own house, and then we provided them with a roof as well. And then we had vocational training so that they were reskilled in other areas. So we took them right out of the brick kiln industry and sort of recycled them back into mainstream society. There's an ongoing process still with that brick kiln of buying slaves and owning them for a period of time and then allowing them to release themselves from bondage.
What an amazing story. And I know that's one of so many other projects that are actually kind of just continuing to burn away and the back burners there, the things that you've actually started, particularly through opportunity. Interesting that you mentioned before about William Wilberforce, and we think about so many of the great reformers have actually been men of Christian faith. Same situation for you as well. Tell me about that faith. Tell me how it began and how it's been nurtured over the years.
My faith journey began, I think, at birth, because I believe that God claimed me at birth. I've always had this concept of God as a father, someone who had a purpose for my life and destiny and who had sustained me through difficult times and who had provided for me, who had given me gifts and skills to bless others. For me, it's been a journey. There is no blinding lights that flashed across the sky and introduced me to Jesus. It's been a process. It's been a hard job for God, I think, because I'm a very impetuous person and sometimes I don't reflect adequately on the things that I get involved in. But my understanding of Christianity is that my actions validate my faith. So I don't search the scripture to find out whether they're something I'm doing is biblical or not. I just do it and have the conviction and the confidence that all my mistakes are redeemed, that there's nothing written in a big black book in heaven that can separate me from the love of God. Yeah, I'm a man of action, so I do things and then do them prayerfully and expect that God will correct me if I'm off track. I get my strength from my prayer life and my relationship with Jesus, but I don't always get clear signs as to whether I should do something or not. And in fact, I have difficulty with a lot of people who spend half their life trying to figure out what their purpose in life is. You know, for me, our God is a creative God. You know, we were created in His image, and by definition, He's a creator. So by definition, we are creators. So my advice is go out and create your own purpose. You determine what your purpose is, and then lift it up to God and pray about it, and He will bless it. But if you just sit back there and wait for God to write it in flashing lights, that's not going to happen very often.
There'll also be a whole bunch of people listening who have actually got a bit of an entrepreneurial streak, and they might be very keen to know from you the steps to actually become a social entrepreneur, somebody who puts their faith into action to see the people that God cares most about, those who actually are most underprivileged in the world, to see them in some way alleviated from their suffering in a way that isn't charity, and you say it well, giving them a hand up rather than a hand out. What advice would you give to people who do feel that kind of sense of stirring to be social entrepreneurs?
Well, I think the first step is a decision that we all have to make, and that is how much is enough.
And by that you mean how much do we live on? How much do we actually consume? How much is enough in that regard?
Yeah, how much more resources do I need to accumulate? You can have a lifestyle which is very extravagant, or you can have a different sort of lifestyle, and you already have accumulated enough. Most of us are so insecure that we don't want to make that first decision. And I think it's difficult for God to take you to the next step until you come to that point where you say, I'm going to release it all, God. I'm going to give it over to you. Once you've made the decision, then you have to be available, because you could position yourself so that you have enough wealth, but then you're not available. So you're not really in God's plan. I think the next thing is that you have to realize is that God expects a return on His investment. And He's invested a lot in me, and He's invested a lot in many other people. And the Bible will tell us that He expects 100-fold. Many of us are only giving Him 5-fold or 1-fold sometimes. Many of us don't sort of view God in that way. We see Him as a compassionate God. But I'm of the opinion that He blesses us only in order that we will bless others. For me, the key word has been release, let go. God's not interested in what we do and what we achieve. He's really interested in what we let go of in order that we can draw closer to Him. So I think that's the first step for a Christian entrepreneur, is that you have to make those first two decisions.
If you were to put it into a phrase, is there something that you would like to have said about you, something that would wrap up what your life has been and the legacy that you could leave?
I don't know. I don't actually look for a legacy to leave. You know, I think that's God's domain, the legacy. But what I would like is that people realize that the most successful thing that I've done is to have a marriage that has stayed together, to have children that are leading purpose-driven lives, to have grandchildren that love the Lord. For me, I can't imagine anything more rewarding to have on your gravestone than you did well.
And on that note, I think we'll end. It's been wonderful talking to you, David Bisseau.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this Sydney's 1032 podcast. To listen to more great audio, visit heart1032.com.au.